The reason people aren't financially free is they don't know what to do and they don't know where to start. I want you to join Joey and I at the Virtual Inner Circle Live, April the 4th through the 6th, as we share with you the exact answers to those questions. We only do this event one time per year. I don't want you to miss out. Go to wealthwalkwallstreet.com/live and enter promo code podcast. When you're at this event, you're going to get your investor DNA. You're going to get access to up to 6 different passive income strategies. So you know, leaving this event, exactly what to do, taking our decades of knowledge so that you can start becoming financially free. Go to wealthwalkwallstreet.com/live and enter the promo code podcast.
Today's guest, Jeff Stevens, is going to teach you some really, really cool things about how to buy houses and maybe even a unique way to buy your own primary residence. Russ, you always have like interesting stories. So tell me, how did you buy your first house?
Well, Jeff, the interview today actually teaches you how to buy houses that are not on the market. And Joey, I was ahead of the game, right? This was, this is like 2003 that we were buying our first house.
Okay.
I bought my first house that was not on the market.
Okay. What do you mean?
It was a little bit unintentional. So we literally call a real estate agent at the real estate place. She goes out and she starts showing us houses. We had a budget of $100,000 at the time. That was a lot of money.
High roller.
Big time, right? and we're looking at houses around Birmingham, and I felt like I was going to get mugged, shot, robbed, you know, whatever, when we were just looking at the houses. And I was like, yeah, this is not going to work. And she said, well, I got 2 or 3 other houses I can show you, but they're a little bit out of town. I mean, it felt like we were driving to Atlanta, but we didn't get quite to Atlanta. But they were definitely in the suburbs. And we get out there. And so we start looking at houses a little bit nicer, neighborhoods, a little bit nicer houses, but still not what you want, right? So we'd probably gone through like 8 houses. And I was getting tired. And I was thinking, man, this is not going to work. So we pull up to this. She said, this is going to be the last house we go see. We pull up in the yard. And I'm like, wow, look at this yard. It's like it was on a corner lot. It's probably an acre, well manicured.
Wow.
We walk up to the door. You know, the realtors always knock on the door, just make sure the homeowner's not there. Well, sure enough, she knocks on the door and, you know, like your grandmom answers the door. And is like, hey, how's it going? And she's like, oh, we were going to like look at the house. I'm sorry, I didn't know you were here. She goes, oh, honey, don't worry about it. It's fine. Come on in. And so we're like, okay, whatever. So we start walking in and she's like, I can show you guys around. You want me to show you? You want to go see the pool? And I was like, pool? Like, heck yeah. As soon as she says that, Joey, our realtor hits us on the shoulder and says, yeah, I tell you what, I'm going to walk outside for a second and make a quick phone call. Why don't you guys just go look around? I'm like, okay, you could tell that she was a little bit disturbed by what was going on.
Yeah.
So we're walking around. We go outside. I'm like, man, pool. Like, it was awesome.
Game on.
She's showing us the house, and it just had the bones to it. It wasn't perfect. You know, no $100,000 house is. But I'm like, man, compared to everything else we looked at, this was the penthouse. We were living it up, right? So real estate agent comes back in. Is like, yeah, did you guys see him? We're like, yeah, this is really great. And we're like, well, thank you so much for letting us show it. And the lady was like, yeah, no problem. It's pretty weird. They just put the sign in the yard an hour ago.
What?
And I was like, oh, wow, man, this is awesome. So we walk outside and real estate agent says, yeah, guys, this house is actually not even on the market yet. The house that I was showing, we're going to take you to, is 6 houses down. Uh-oh. And I was like, dang, no wonder that thing was so nice.
Figures.
It couldn't fit in our budget. So we drive down the street and we walk around this other house like, no, this thing didn't have a pool. It didn't have a nice yard.
At this point, you're way behind.
Oh,
compared
man.
To that
one. We have now test drove something nicer, right? That idea of a luxury once enjoyed becomes a necessity. Mm. This house became a necessity. So we went to dinner that night. We did the little Benjamin Franklin pros and cons list. And we're like, all right, what's the price on this house? And she's like, well, I talked to the real estate agent. They hadn't even put it in MLS yet, and they were going to put it on the market for $111,000. And I was like, ooh, you know, you may be laughing, like $11,000, Russ, but that's like 10% higher than what we were going to spend. And I was like, all right, let's put an offer in at $106,000. We got it at $108,000, and I was swimming by the end of the month.
Man, look at you. You just happened upon a deal that was off the market.
I literally did. Our real estate agent was a complete moron,
but it totally worked out in our favor because she probably wouldn't even showed us that house because it was 10% over what I said our top price point was.
And there's no telling what you can get when you're looking for houses not on the market. I think today's interview is going to be much more interesting than that story, but it's also going to show you how to buy a house off the market and potentially be not only an investment opportunity, but also something you can do for your primary house.
Yeah, I loved to hear Jeff talking about how just being a little bit different than the rest of the crowd of investors out there could give you such a huge advantage when it comes to building a rental portfolio, to getting to financial freedom. That's ultimately where this kind of falls in your journey is, are you still looking for that course, that path to build your passive income? Maybe it's through long-term rentals, and maybe this is the way to do it. So I think you're going to pick up a lot of nuggets from Jeff. As in the name of his company, The Thoughtful Real Estate Investor, you're going to pick up, he's very empathic. Like, he wants to understand situations with each seller and then make sure it works for him and them. He looks for win-wins. Anyways, what else would you add to that?
No, these are all great takeaways, Joey, and I don't want to waste any more opportunity. I want to share Jeff with you. Let's jump into our interview with Jeff Stevens.
Welcome to the Wealth Without Wall Street podcast, your guide to understanding how to get out of the Wall Street rat race and start your own mailbox money lifestyle. Now, don't let these handsome Southern draws fool you. These financial minds are teaching our country to enhance savings, increase cash flow, and create passive income, all without the help of Wall Street. Are you ready to break through? Now, here are your hosts, Russ Morgan and Joey Murray.
Are you looking for ways to implement ideas, get exposure to new ones, and be surrounded by people on the same journey as you? Joey, where can they go to do that?
Go to wealthwithoutwallstreet.com/community. You can join for free today. Welcome, and I hope you are ready to think with today's guest, Jeff Stevens, the thoughtful real estate entrepreneur. Jeff, so glad to have you on the show, man.
I'm honored to be here. Thanks for making me part of the show.
Well, you said in our pre-show, Jeff, that the greatest compliment that you could receive is being thoughtful. And that obviously holds true with the name of your business. What's behind that? Where did that come from?
Yeah. Thanks for asking. Yeah. You know, whenever I would, if I would do something, like maybe I send a seller I just talked to a thank you card, for instance, if they send me an email and say, thanks, it was very thoughtful of you to send that, that word always resonated with me. And I thought to myself, like, that's kind of what I want to strive to be more and more and more of all the time. And so then I started to really focus on, well, what does thoughtful mean in the context of real estate and how I do it? And it really means two things. One is it's just being really, really intentional about what we're doing at all, why we're doing what we're doing, where are we trying to take this thing, instead of just going out and kind of doing deals and flailing around and trying to take a lot of action, but without a lot of purpose. So it was being very deliberate and intentional. And then the second thing, though, the thoughtful part is really more about empathy. What I do is very people oriented. I like to say that we're always shopping for people who have properties more than we're shopping for properties. And the whole approach to the conversation, the negotiation is much more about the people. And so I think the empathy side of there, you have to stop and think and just be thoughtful about what is the other person, what do they care about? What are they thinking about? What are their perceptions? And then take the whole approach that way. So that's what thoughtful means to me.
Well, you kind of hold yourself out there as the anti-we buy houses guy, which I love, by the way, because we love like slapping people in the face that we're without Wall Street.
Yeah.
So what is it about the we buy houses group or model that you disagree with?
Yeah, we'll just go right into the offensive part of all this. Right,
I love
right
it. This away. Is the part that excites me.
Okay. So I believe generally speaking, and these are generalizations, but I think when people who are not in real estate see a sign that says we buy houses, it's like a button that they push that like it paints a whole picture in their mind. Now, for better or for worse, whether it's accurate or not, that those words and that approach, it kind of it just conjures up a particular idea. And that's not an idea that I have ever felt like I wanted to be associated with. There was a time very early in my career, way before I turned into the thoughtful real estate entrepreneur, but you know, when I was just like, you know, scrambling around trying to figure it out like everybody else. And I did certain things that like the real estate investing industry just says you're supposed to do. You know, you send yellow letters and you put up bandit signs and you look for distressed people and distressed properties and stuff. And all of that stuff just felt super gross to me. I felt terrible about myself, right? Which is, it says more about me than it does about, you know, the tactics necessarily, but it just was not, it was not a fit for me at all. I just felt gross. I felt sleazy. And so when I started then kind of putting together my thoughts about like, well, how do I explain what it is I want to teach people on a podcast or whatever? I had to like take something people could already relate to and then try to position what I was trying to talk about in relation to what they already understood. And everybody kind of knows what the We Buy Houses thing is. And so I felt like, well, if I said, you know, that's on one end of the spectrum, well, what we're doing is really on the other end, maybe that would help clarify a little bit, but I'm not sure if it's worked or not.
Well, let's talk about what, you know, if the We Buy Houses is looking for people who are distressed and needing out, and it's about buying the house at the lowest price, and you say you're at, on the other end, talk about similarities and differences in what you do, because I think today's podcast is really interesting because you focus on buying properties with seller financing. And yeah. I want to like bring that out, but I would love to kind of compare and contrast what your style is and the things that you do and teach others to do.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't think there's anything intrinsically wrong with distressed properties or quote motivated sellers, right? Because the positive spin on that whole thing is these people are in need of a solution, and a real estate investor shows up and they give them the solution that they need to kind of get out of that problem. You know, the less positive way of thinking of it is that it's exploitative. And I don't really, honestly, I don't get too hung up in either of those things, to be honest with you. What I focus on is the fact that a quote motivated seller or a distressed property might as well have like neon signs up on the roof going, hey, come talk to me about giving me a low offer. You know, like it just, it attracts anybody and everybody. Like it doesn't take any like real sophistication to see those signs and go like, oh, wait a minute. Maybe there's an opportunity to buy something low so I can later sell it high. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's very, very simplistic. And what I like actually is I like to be able to sit down in the living room with a seller and not feel like there's a lot of competition, not feel like, oh, they've received four offers this week. They're expecting two more. They're going to sort through them. That's a very, very commoditized transactional type of approach. I would much rather just sit down in their living room, know that we're just having a conversation where we're exploring something. And I have this opinion that like no seller enters into a conversation unless they are motivated. So if you go out into the real estate investing, you know, world or Facebook groups or whatever, people always say like, oh, I'm trying to look for motivated sellers. And I keep finding people that aren't that motivated. And my response to them is always that if they called you back from a letter you sent them or something, they are motivated. The question isn't whether they are motivated. The question is whether you have the sophistication or savvy to be able to uncover what that motivation is, because it might not be blindingly obvious, you know, like a house that hasn't had the lawn mowed in a year.
So I want to make this very practical for somebody hearing this for the first time, maybe. So everybody is kind of familiar with that We Buy Ugly Houses or We Buy Houses model. And it is kind of like this idea that, oh man, somebody's being taken advantage of in this process and the other person's winning.
Yeah.
Explain how maybe an example of a deal where you went into it and maybe they've been talked to by other people and it didn't work out because for whatever reason, and then you being able to kind of filter it through the way you think about real estate, were able to make a solution happen. Is that, mm-hmm. is that a fair question? Like, do you have an example like that you could share that maybe make it more real?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And actually, this is a really great way to naturally segue into talking about seller financing too. So I'm thinking of a scenario where I bought a fiveplex a few years ago. And I had sent a letter. It was my standard thing. I sent a nice letter to this person, and he calls me back and he says, "Yeah, I got your letter. I'd be interested in talking to you about it." Right on the phone, he says, "Yeah, you know, the tax records say this thing's worth $1 million, but I just think that's out of sight." And I was like, "Oh, really? What do you mean by it's out of sight?" And he's like, "Oh, I don't see how it could possibly be worth that much." Like, okay. All right.
Man, that is like exactly this. What that's you want to hear. That's the kind of call you want right there.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, and actually, as a little side note, like, it's so important not to make assumptions about what people are saying too. And just like, keep my mouth quiet, ask him to clarify. "Oh, really? You know, tell me more," you know, and then, then he says this thing that of course I'm really glad to hear. So later that afternoon, I'm at his house, right? And sitting there talking to him and his wife in their living room. And he mentions that he had been receiving an offer from actually a real estate broker for a few months. And this offer was a little bit lower than what he felt the property was worth. And I said, "Well, would you mind, just so I have a frame of reference, like telling me what that offer was that you didn't like so much?" And he said, I'd rather have you come up with your best number and let me know." And I said, okay. And, but I didn't really want to take that for an answer. So I had to keep figuring out other ways to ask him like the same question in new ways. And so then he mentioned that he had countered and he just never really heard back from that other buyer. And I said, "Okay, well, I know you don't want to share the price or whatever that the other offer was. Would you mind telling me what you countered at that they never responded to?" And he's like, "Oh, sure." And so, and the answer was, $850. And I thought, okay, that's great. And as we started to talk more, now I knew at this moment before I ever showed up at this person's doorstep that I was expecting that there could be an opportunity for seller financing, and I was hoping for it. But I don't want to just show up and walk through the door and it's like, "Here's Jeff's agenda. Let me start asking you the questions about this." I want to uncover from him all of the clues that will then allow me to propose seller financing to him, but make it not look like it's what I wanted at all, but it's what he wanted. So I was asking him about, you know, "So are you planning to do maybe a 1031 exchange? You're just going to sort of suck it up and, you know, pay the capital gains tax? You know, you've owned this thing 30 years. And he said, "No, we really don't want to pay the capital gains tax. We don't want to do the 1031 exchange. As part of what we didn't like about the other offer was we were just going to get cashed out and have to pay the bill." And, you know, my ears are just going ding, 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 ding. Oh my God, this is amazing. This is exactly what I was hoping for. But I didn't want to just show up and start talking about what I want immediately. So I put all this together and I said, "Okay, sir, let me just see if I understand then. Is it safe to say that if I could give you the price that you countered the other buyer at, but we structured it in a way that you didn't have to have this capital gains, we kind of used a seller financing tactic," because he already knew that was the solution too. "Is it safe to assume that would be a good thing for you?" And he's like, "Yes, it would." So that afternoon, we got it written up, but it came because the other person was not listening to what he wanted. Like his number one thing was, "I don't want to pay the capital gains. I want to structure this deal to feather it out over a lot of time." And so, but I did hear that and I was super excited to hear that. And then we put the deal together as a result.
That's such a great example.
So from a practical standpoint, you went into the property knowing that I want to buy it. You probably had an estimate of what you wanted to pay for it, but you wanted it seller finance because your end goal when you buy a property, seller finance, what do you do with it the majority of the time?
I'm mostly a long-term rental guy. And so okay. I plan to just put this into my rental pool. The location was incredible. The property itself, not the most beautiful piece of architecture in the world, but the location was really good. Extremely close. I mean, quick walk to a lot of my other properties. Yeah. And so it had kind of a strategic purpose as well. But yeah, long-term rental.
All right. So you went in, you said, "All right, this is a fiveplex." You probably had already evaluated the rental rate for each unit. And so you kind of had an idea of, if I do seller financing, if I can get these terms, then it makes it a good deal for me to do it on my rental side.
Yeah. I have this rule of my for myself that is, something has to be awesome about every deal I do. Something has to be like fall out of your chair good. And that could be a lot of different things. It could be the location. It could be the beauty and the quality and the romance of the building. It could be the price, obviously. It could be some element of the terms. You know, like I'll pay a very benign market rate price if I can put $7 down, right? I mean, that by itself is so ridiculously awesome that I would then... It's like an algebraic equation. Like I will just solve for awesome. Like, fine. I don't care about the rest of the terms. We're going to isolate the $7 down payment and the rest, it doesn't really matter too much. And in this case, the location was awesome. The building itself wasn't awesome. I could already tell the price was going to be reasonable from the very first conversation we had. And now we're getting to the seller financing thing. So there were actually multiple levels of awesome in this particular case.
And when you say seller financing, so I think traditionally people think about real estate in terms of price only, right? They think, yeah. Oh, I got a great price on this property, so that means I win. But in your case, you've got a more sophistication to be able to look at that. If I got a good price on a property, but then I had to go get bad terms mm-hmm. because the financing options weren't very good, I still don't win. So in this case, you could say, man, I didn't necessarily get the lowest possible price, but I got great terms. Explain what great terms would be for somebody learning this maybe for the first time.
Okay. There are a lot of levels to this answer. So I'm gonna go with kind of the simplest level, but then I'll just tease the PhD level if I can real quickly, not to imply that I'm a PhD. I'm just saying that there's a more exciting element to this too. But
come on, doctor, just hit us with it, doc.
All right,
come on.
All right. So seller financing, first of all, the seller financing is a massive umbrella of a lot of different things, right? We've got lease options and subject twos and also all sorts of creative. It's basically anything where there's not a bank or a giant duffel bag of cash that you brought to the closing table, right? And so if the seller is involved in any way, you could probably call that seller financing. What I do primarily is I buy the property and I make payments to the seller over time. I become the owner, they become the beneficiary of a promissory note. And so it's a fairly simple structure. But if you think about what defines a promissory note, there's a lot of different bullet points, you know, so to speak, in a promissory note. There's certainly the thing what everybody would be first thinking about is an interest rate. There's a down payment. There is a payment structure. There is a duration of term. There is, you know, whether there'll be taxes and insurance will be escrowed. How does the person receive the money? When does the interest start accruing? When do the payments start? There's a lot of different things. And so I think of this as, have you ever seen, you might be sitting in front of one right now, a big mixing board at an audio studio. There's like 1,000 knobs on this thing. And you're like, oh yes. My God, what all these knobs do? But a promissory note, it's kind of like the same thing. There's all these different things that you can tweak. And if the seller's really feeling, you know, like this interest rate thing, they're like, nah, it needs to be 4, not 3.75. Then okay, great. Maybe we twist this other knob just a little bit to balance it out. So to answer your question simply, the great thing about seller financing is you actually get to look at all the knobs and have some say in all of them. Whereas if you're just talking to Wells Fargo, they're like, here's our program. You literally have zero say in any of these terms at all. The only say you have is yes or no, not what if interest started accruing 27 days from closing instead of at closing, because I need a little time to repair this unit, which, you know, is decreasing the, you know, the income and all this kind of stuff that we can tweak and adjust. It's like a tailor, you know, you can buy your clothes off the rack or you can go to a tailor, and a tailor is certainly going to do a better job of creating something that looks as good as it possibly can and meets both parties' needs.
Yes, I don't know about that. I don't know if I agree, Jeff.
Yes, they do.
I mean, Joey. That J. Crew I'm wearing versus Russ's tailoring. I mean,
yes, they do.
I think the person inside the clothes really, you know, makes it. So Russ has to overcompensate sometimes.
So let's talk about, like, in this example with just kind of staying on this fiveplex. So you went to him. His thing was price to some degree. His thing was
capital gains.
Didn't want to pay the capital gains rate. So how long do you typically create terms with somebody? For this example, how long was he willing to hold the note for you? And
are the majority of the deals you're getting, are they holding the note until what you think would be the completion of the property, or do you have an expectation of going back in and refinancing it out with a traditional bank at some point?
My answer is that I negotiate the longest note I possibly can. I mean, if they do 117 years, I'm in, you know. pretty much the shortest time I will ever do is about 7 years.
Okay.
I would say on average might end up being probably about 10. And there's a couple reasons for that. Most of these people want to take their capital gains problem and punt it, but they don't want to punt it 100 yards. They want to punt it like 20 yards. You know, they just want to deal with it right now. A lot of the people that I buy properties from are, I don't know exactly why, but I bet if we drew a chart, it would be 70. They'd be average like 70. And so at that point, they're like, well, I don't think I want to sign up for a 30-year note. Right. But they end up with like a 10-year kind of an average would be, that would be typical for me.
And on that, are you doing like a 10-year AM, or is it, I'm going to pay you for 10 years, but we're amortizing it over 20, 30 or longer period?
Yeah, good question. So that too is just, that's one of the little dials on the conversation that we can adjust. What I would like to see happen would be that my payments are interest only. Or more. Yeah. Like I have the opportunity to pay more if I want to, but my minimum committed payment each month is an interest only payment, which is important for a few reasons. One is it effectively allows me to amortize it however I want to, and even change that amortization over time, right? I can make extra principal payments when I want to. But also in my market, you know, I'm out here on the left side of the US, and the old rent to price ratio is not awesome. On our deal. So we actually need to keep our debt service low so that we can maintain, you know, a reasonable level of cash flow.
And then is your expectation down the road to get a bank to come back and refinance out and pay them off?
Possibly. My goal is to never work with a bank if I don't have to.
Yes.
Yeah.
Love hearing that.
Yeah. I will do an opportunistic bank refinance if I don't really need it and they're offering something that's great for me, then I will pursue that. But I don't want to ever put myself in a position where I have to. So my goal with these properties with seller financing would be either, if I get to the end of that term, would be either to maybe sell the property, possibly to refinance it. I might refinance it with somebody else's private money instead. But you know, these are longer term notes. I mean, 10 years, like I'm saying, on average. So we don't have a lot of, you know, maturity dates that are coming up all the time. They're pretty infrequent. But if we had to turn to a bank, we could. But I always look to find ways to not do that.
I love it. You're just music to our ears. You know, we want to become the bank. We don't want to go to the bank.
Yes.
At Wealth.Wall Street. So I want to transition really quick because one of the things. It's actually in the same vein, but your most recent podcast talked about how to buy your primary residence in a way like this, using this creativity and the seller financing vehicle, a case study. Could you share with us, like for somebody listening, they get fired up about this idea. Maybe they say, I would love to apply this to my personal situation. Yeah, and
is there a way to do that?
Yeah. How could somebody do that?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Great point. So I've been an entrepreneur a long time. I don't really have a W-2. My wife does have a W-2, but we're not the kind of people who just waltz into US Bank and be like, hey, look at me. I'm the perfect candidate, right? So if we want to move, I'm going to have to figure out something kind of creative. So about maybe a year and a half ago, we started this process. And so I said, I'm just going to do exactly what I do for investment deals for our primary residence, but we're going to be hyper, hyper focused. So the first thing we did is we said, like, what exactly do we want in a property? And then how can I translate those attributes into something I can ask my title company to query the database of county records for? So in other words, like we knew we wanted to live in kind of an established neighborhood with big, big trees. We didn't want little saplings that had just been planted, for instance. We just wanted that feel. So my list said, okay, well, I want homes built before, say, the year 1990, because that means those neighborhoods are going to be, you know, more mature. And so we went through this whole process and said, what are these attributes? But the number one attribute that was most important to me actually had nothing to do with the property. It was all about the person who owned the property, because the number one thing that was going to unlock my ability to do this deal was if I could make payments to the seller over time, which, and that's my secret sauce anyway. So really we asked for a list that was primary or that was entirely absentee owners. So basically people who own rental properties and people who owned rental properties for a long time. Like in this case, I think we asked for 10 years or more. So now I've got a small list of people in very specific geographic parts of town that are landlords of properties they've owned for a while. And all of that together means they have capital gains problems. And people who have capital gains problems are way more amenable to the idea of seller financing. And also, secondarily, they have rental properties probably because they like income. So if they sell the rental property, there goes the income. So we come along and it's like, this is the perfect solution. It helps you defer your capital gains. It continues to give you an income stream. So we pull the list. And in this case, the list was really quite small. It was maybe 200 or 300 people and their properties. And we screened them as a small enough list so we could just screen each one individually. And then we just simply sent a letter. We sent the same letter we basically sent to anybody. And this one particular seller, I mean, we got a lot of calls, but this one particular seller called back and it seemed pretty quickly like this was going to be a good fit. He was more than open to the idea of having me make payments to him over time. So here's where it got a little bit more creative is that he said, we agreed on a price and he said, I want $150,000 down. I thought, okay, I think that's reasonable. That was about 25% or so. Certainly it's about 149,000 more than I really wanted, you know, but I was like, well, I can understand.
More than $7.
Yeah, exactly. Dang it. So, and I just didn't have the liquidity at that moment. So I said, well, how about this? What if we lease this property from you with the option to buy to begin with? I'll give you $20,000 as an option fee now. And we'll have, you know, 18 months or so to exercise our option. And it'll give me a little time to go put together the other funds. And when I've got that extra 130, then I'll come back to you and I will exercise my option to buy the property. And I will become the owner and you will be the beneficiary and we'll make payments to you over time that way. So that's basically what we did. We basically put two creative deal structure seller financing programs like back to back. So the first one was this lease option that allowed us to get in the house and just start living here and start living our lives, give me a little time to throw the rest of the money together. We exercised the option and now we're the owners and he's the beneficiary and we make payments to him each month.
That is so cool. I love this idea. Is how would someone learn how to do this? Obviously you've taken, you know, 10 years almost, you know, practicing and implementing real estate investing. How does someone who's listening to us right now who goes, this is interesting, what would I do next? What would you tell them?
Yeah, it's a good question. I actually think there's some learning and there might be some unlearning that has to happen. Because what I'm talking about is it's pretty different than I think a lot of the mainstream real estate investing education.
Oh, for sure.
And there's nothing wrong with the mainstream real estate investing education, but it does kind of make you think like, okay, the key to success is you buy something for more and you buy it low and then you sell it high. And you know, you buy properties when the bank will allow you to buy properties. And the most important thing is to have a good agent and all that kind of stuff. And like everything I'm talking about, it's really kind of the opposite. So the first thing I guess is somehow opening up your mind to the idea that maybe all those paradigms are one way of looking at it, but that there could be a completely different way of looking at it too. I know I mentioned before, like just one of the simple headline kind of shifts is stop shopping for a property and instead start shopping for a person. That would be one simple paradigm shift, but easier said than done. There's not a ton of content that I'm aware of that's out there. I mean, so I'm trying like for my podcast and stuff like that to be a voice that just plants those seeds in people's minds about different ways of doing things. But I think at the end of the day, even if we set seller financing aside, what it really all comes down to is, are you willing to get good at the art of sitting in someone's living room and just having a conversation and exploring the options? And I think what we do is it's very much a left brain, right brain thing that they really come together. It's not so much only about deal analysis. It's about asking good questions, reading between the lines of the answers of those questions, listening for clues that then you can use to, you know, like in my fiveplex story, I got all the inputs I needed from the seller so that when I proposed seller financing to him, it wasn't about like, well, here's what Jeff wants. It's about, here's what you told me you wanted to accomplish, sir. Here's an idea I have that I think could get you there. So I'm not sure if that eloquently answers the question, but it's like an education and an uneducation process, I think, in this.
Well, and besides your podcast, are there any other resources or courses or anything like that that you would recommend?
I learned most of what I know how to do from having a coach, Greg Pinio, who's at that event, you know, where I met you guys as well. So he's got education courses and programs and events and stuff like that. And so that's, I would certainly highly, highly recommend that kind of stuff. I think there are books about seller financing and all of that. So I think you can learn some of the technical tools on all of that, but you know, tools are tools in a toolbox, and there's the application of those tools that really matters. And I think that's one thing where you kind of have to, you can't necessarily read that in a book. You have to get out there and practice the art of applying those tools with real people in real life situations.
That's really cool. Well, man, this is so good, Jeff. Thank you so much for sharing this. I hope that people will come and interact with you both in our community, but also go check out your podcast, Racking Up Rentals, and you know, go to your website and try to, you know, see if this is something that would help you get closer to financial freedom. If they wanted to reach out to you or find out more, where would you point them to?
Yeah, thank you very much. Our website is thoughtfulre.com. You know, we've got Facebook groups and stuff like that too. But if we just go to thoughtfulre.com, would be a good hub.
Awesome. Man, Jeff, it was awesome to meet you at the Brian Tripp event that we were both in October, and now to kind of come full circle, have you on the podcast and share you with the audience. Really grateful for your time today.
Oh, thank you for your interest in this approach. I hope I hope it made sense to people and maybe just gets the wheels turning in a slightly different way.
No doubt.
No doubt. Well, thank you as always for listening to the show, and have an amazing day.
This has been the Wealth Without Wall Street podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show to break free of the Wall Street mindset and begin building wealth on your own terms in places you understand, so that your wealth will never run dry. See you next episode.